This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald.
I'm Ramya Amadhin, and this is Kelly and Ramya.
Live from the Accessible Media Studios, this is Kelly and Ramya. Entertainment, lifestyle, and great conversation. It's AMI's on-air community, and everyone's invited.
Welcome to the show. It's Kelly and Ramya, and we're here with you 2 p.m. Eastern Time every weekday on AMI TV. That's when you catch us live. Kelly McDonald and Ramya Amadhin, we're here, and I wanted to give a quick shout out to all of my community members. If you're Tamil and you celebrated Tamil New Year over the weekend, then happy Tamil New Year to you. A brand new start to a brand new year, and hopefully a lot of great celebrating going on. Kels, in my household, in my family, that just meant a lot of food.
And I was just going to say, I don't think it would take a lot to twist my arm or anyone else's to guess
celebrate?
Food.
Oh.
No, to just guess right. But yes, that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was a fun time, and especially because it landed on a Sunday / Saturday, depending on when you celebrated. But, you know, it's the diaspora of Tamil community members just kind of spread across the country or around the world. It's very different from place to place and generation to generation how we take in these things, but it's just a fun time overall.
So what would have been the feature food?
There is no feature
for
food for us anymore, but my mom likes to stick to the sweet side. So, you know, traditional sweet things like kesari or what she calls sweet rice, which is kind of really reminiscent of oatmeal if you compare. Not a fan. So I don't really want to get into the controversies. No.
Oh, that's too bad. Okay. Well, I don't
mostly
need to
there's
I just
raisins.
Need to know that Kelly'd probably like it.
Probably.
Oh, no. That controversy. So it is a show related.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, all about your poor taste or not liking raisin. Anyway, question.
Anyway, yes, question, because I love intriguing you with these questions. Do you prefer the morning, afternoon, or evening sun coming through the windows into your home? And also, which
the morning.
Get?
Mm. The morning, I get the morning. It shines well on my cereal with my raisins.
And do you have some morning sun now? Have you always?
No, at this time. Obviously, since I've been here, always have. But I lose it around 11:30 a.m., 12:30, depending on the time change.
Okay. So you really get the morning, early afternoon.
Yeah.
At my old place, I would get full afternoon sun, south-facing windows, and just the afternoon would be gorgeous. It was really lovely to see, like, Glasgow find the stream of rays that he could lie down in and really enjoy that. Now I get evening sun, but not fully, though. It's kind of like that cross window evening sun.
Yeah, because your building's angled. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So it's nice, but it's not as nice as having so much sun for such a long period of time in the afternoon.
So you really do like it in the afternoon. See, I like the morning. I prefer the evening to be just wonderfully without the sun.
Gosh,
especially when it's hot.
I know. It is hot, but still, a little bit of sun any time of day is appreciated.
Let a little sunshine pour into your life.
Exactly. Let's see what's coming up on today's edition of Kelly and Ramya. We're talking about work-life balance. It's a well-worn phrase that means something a little different for each of us, and we're going to discuss the implications of too much work, which is burnout, with Francis Wong.
Community reporter Julie Martin features the Healthy Tomorrow Foundation's community walking program that's helping Nova Scotians get more active.
Yes, let's celebrate that as well. Also, on this month's Voices Chat, we invite manager of AMI Audio, Andy Frank, to the soapbox. He's going to brief us on some upcoming AMI events and remotes. Also, we're talking formulas for podcasts because, you know, we got a lot going on in the podcast world. Walmart Canada, they want to deal with reusable bags. They're launching a national pilot program so customers can recycle the chain's reusable shopping bags.
Customers can send in their extra or damaged Walmart reusable blue shopping bags, and a company called TerraCycle is either going to wash them and donate them to charity partners or recycle them. Walmart says recycled bags will be processed into raw materials that can be then made into things like shipping pallets and outdoor furniture. Walmart Canada stopped offering plastic bags 2 years ago this month, months before the federal government banned them. Dawn Kelly, The Canadian Press.
So yesterday I was going through my very neat and organized pile of recyclable bags and reusable bags and thinking, do you always get the ratio that you want with these? Like, you know how you bring them or maybe you swap things or use them to deliver things to other people, and then you end up still getting enough back that you never miss out on recyclable or reusable bags. So anyways, there's always room to get rid of these bags now too, Kels. So I think that it's kind of a step in the right direction to be able to do something else with these bags other than just let them pile them up in your homes.
And I agree. I think that you're probably right. I think probably that you may get caught saying, geez, I wanted to buy more and I didn't bring enough bags, whatever. The thing I think a lot about is the reusable in the sense of making sure how you clean them. Because, yep, yes, it's nice to have the bags, but you still can bring little friends home from the grocery store or other, or you forget. You take the stuff out, you put everything away, you put your bag, but did you go in and clean them? Did you do so? Did you throw them in the laundry? And that by the ones that can go, the cloth ones. And I think that's where some people really need to think, because they don't want to lose a bag if it's a cloth one, that's something they've paid for. But it has that benefit of things timed out right into the laundry they go. You may keep from having you ever wonder, how did that roach get in here?
Yeah, well, that's fair, too. And also just, you know, as you say, where are we taking the bags? Is there enough of the transition that has happened that we're normalizing using these reusable bags? I don't think so, because there's so many different kinds out there, the yes, use and the care of it, as you said, but also do we even remember to keep them with us,
yeah,
so that we're not purchasing
and you don't even necessarily know if you have any in it. Sure, you might have your bag that, you know, hey, I usually put meat, yeah, in here. This is the one I've got to really clean because there could be blood or whatever. I think those, especially being sight impaired, that's kind of the thing to worry about.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, good luck to Walmart, and hopefully it's the right direction. Let's talk about, after the break with Dr. Danielle Jeankind, how common it is for our pets to get problems with their eyes and how we can start noticing the symptoms so we can help out. We're exploring that topic on Ask a Vet, so stick around. This is Kelly and Rumia. You're listening to Kelly and Rumia, or watching on AMI TV or on your favorite podcast, where you can find us whenever you want. That's where you can search for Kelly and Rumia. Let's get into Ask a Vet. This is a conversation we have on Tuesdays with Dr. Danielle Jeankind, our veterinarian.
Whether they provide us with companionship, an income, food, or serve a critical role in the ecosystems that support us, animals are vital to human health. Have fun with us as we learn about animal-related topics and about the amazing bond we share with our animal friends.
So our pets could get problems and experience health issues in all kinds of different body systems, but one we don't talk about all the time is when our pets get eye disease. So let's talk about today what kinds of things can go wrong with our pets' eyes and what we might notice if they do end up having some kind of eye issues and what can be done for them. Danielle, this is what you're going to be going over with us today. So how common is it for our pets to get problems with their eyes?
Well, actually, it's really common for them to get eye problems, though, of course, not all eye abnormalities lead to really bad, you know, issues for the pet. Many of the most common ones are things we see all the time. You know, for example, we see these rusty colored kind of tear tracks running down the face of some breeds of dogs. You know, tear stain remover products actually became a thing because this is so common. Of course, there are lots of other disease processes, though, that can lead to eye problems that, of course, unfortunately, aren't so benign.
Oh, boy. When we think about eye problems in pets, what other diseases come to mind, Danielle?
Well, you know, eyes, of course, can be affected by bacteria and viruses, just like any other body tissues. We also see inflammation in the eyes, you know, sometimes secondary to a problem with the immune system reacting inappropriately to something in the body or the environment. things can also go wrong with the structures in the eye too. You know, sometimes the lenses can become cloudy. The iris, the colored part of the eye that expands and contracts to allow light into the eye, can have issues. And sometimes we even see certain types of cancer that can affect the eye. The other thing about eyes is that, you know, people have this saying that, you know, the eyes are the window to the soul. Well, they're almost like a window into the rest of the body too, in a medical sense, because some diseases that affect the whole body will show symptoms in the eyes as well. So, you know, a pet with eye disease, they might be squinting a lot, they might be rubbing at their face or their eyes, they might have discharge coming from the eyes as well. If they suddenly lose their vision, they might be bumping into things where they never used to. They might trip or fall down the stairs, which would be unusual, especially if they're outside or in an unfamiliar environment. And you might see other behavioral changes too. You know, they might yelp or jump when someone goes to touch them because they can't see you coming and they weren't expecting someone to be there, for example. Any color changes, spots or cloudiness in the eyes, of course, you know, should be looked at by your veterinarian too.
Okay. Let's talk about common eye diseases then in pets.
Sure. So the tear staining problem I mentioned earlier is actually very common in dogs, especially the flat-faced and small or toy breeds. So tears actually have a pigment called porphyrin in them. So if they spill out over the eyelids and run down the face instead of draining away down a duct like they're supposed to, the fur on the face gets stained this rusty brown kind of red color. Some dogs have this almost right from day one. You know, while others will develop it later, and that is usually secondary to another eye problem. It's mostly a cosmetic issue unless it was caused by another problem first. If it is a new thing, you should take your pet to see the vet to kind of rule out other issues. But the best thing, of course, to watch out for with this is to keep the hair on the face as short as possible and to keep it as clean and as dry as possible. Pets with this tear spilling over problem, they'll sometimes get skin infections from the skin being wet and dirty and crusty all the time. So keeping the hair short, keeping it clean and dry is the best way to prevent that. Another problem I see on a regular basis is conjunctivitis, which is when the tissues around the eyes are inflamed. I see this a lot when dogs go to doggy daycare or when they go to leash-free parks. Somebody gets it, they go to socialize with their dog buddies, and then it goes around the whole group. Kind of like kids in kindergarten, right?
Yep.
So, you know, these scenarios are very commonly caused by bacterial infections, sometimes viruses. We typically notice this green or yellow goo coming out of the eyes and the pet is uncomfortable. They're squinting a lot and rubbing at their eyes. If the infection is bad enough, sometimes it can cause a wound on the cornea. The cornea is this clear window-like covering on the surface of the eye. And, you know, we call these wounds corneal ulcers. Ulcers are pretty common too, and they can be caused by more than just infections. You know, sometimes we see them caused by trauma, where a pet gets scratched on its eye or gets poked in the eye by something. And of course, there are lots of other eye issues that come in too, but these are probably the ones I see most often.
So I, the other day, was at the optometrist, so this is really good timing, too, for a much overdue check. I think I've had too many conversations on this show making me feel guilty, and now I can sit up proudly and not hide and say, oh, yeah, that's still something I have to do. What they did with me is a bunch of checking, looking, testing, I guess you'd want to say, stuff that I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember this. But what kind of tests do vets do, if any, to detect any eye disease?
Well, an eye exam includes looking at the eye and the structures around it, you know, so we're checking the eyelids and the red membranes around the eye that we call the conjunctiva. Mm-hmm. We also look at the structures within the eye with an ophthalmoscope and sometimes with a bright light and a magnifying lens. We also have a few tests we can do right in the exam room. There is a special dye called fluorescein, and we can put that into the eye. And what its purpose is it sticks to areas of the cornea that are damaged. So it helps us to see and detect ulcers more easily. We can also measure tear production with special strips of paper by doing what's called a Schirmer tear test. I kind of always like the Schirmer tear test because they have these little lines of blue dye in them. And as the tears wet, the paper strip down, the blue dye moves up with the tears. And it's kind of pretty, actually. Maybe I'm crazy. It's a vet thing, you know. But like people, pets can get glaucoma, and that causes the pressure in the eyes to go up. And so we have special instruments called tonometers for measuring that pressure inside the eye. Your vet might also take some swabs to check for bacteria or viruses, or they might want to take them to look at the cells that rub off on the swabs under a microscope. And, you know, the other thing that we can't forget is what I mentioned before, that eye symptoms may be part of a larger disease process. So, for example, if I see an elderly kitty that suddenly goes blind and I look with the ophthalmoscope and see that the retinas have detached from the back of the eye, I already know I should check that kitty for kidney disease and for high blood pressure too. So for that reason, your vet might recommend other testing like blood work, urinalysis, or blood pressure testing to make sure there isn't anything else going on that we don't know about.
Wow, the associated tips of something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Danielle, can we talk about treatments that are available for eye diseases?
Sure. So, I mean, there are lots of effective options that are available. And sometimes, you know, we can't cure a problem, but we might be able to manage it so that the pet has good quality of life. And, you know, what we recommend, of course, really depends on what's wrong, like what's going wrong with the eye. Simple, uncomplicated eye infections and ulcers, you know, we might be able to clear up with some antibiotic eye drops or some ointment. If we find the immune system or inflammation is causing problems, you know, we might treat with immunosuppressive or anti-inflammatory medications. Sometimes these come in the form of eye drops, or sometimes we might decide that an oral medication is a better choice. In some cases, surgery is recommended. Some really bad corneal ulcers and conditions like a third eyelid gland prolapse, among others, they might need surgery to fix. And, you know, sometimes surgically removing a blind, painful eye is recommended when medical management has failed. And, you know, we need to preserve a pet's quality of life. There's really no point to letting them live in chronic pain, you know, when removing the blind eye will alleviate that for them. I mentioned our example of the elderly kitty with retinal detachment earlier, and, you know, sometimes treating the underlying disease will help to manage the eye problem too. So, you know, if we know if our example high, or our example kitty has high blood pressure, you know, then we may have to bring that pressure down with some medication and treat the kidney disease that caused it, because that would be really important too. And the one thing that, you know, we can't ever forget about, it's really critical to make sure that we treat pain appropriately with eye disease in our pets. Inflamed eyes are painful eyes. And the other thing I will mention is the use of an e-collar. I know pets hate to wear them and that clients hate to make their pets wear them. Mm-hmm. But rubbing at diseased eyes is only going to make things worse. So we don't want that to happen either.
Some of them are just so skilled at taking it off anyway.
They're Houdinis, right? They're like magicians. Yeah. I'm not staying in here. Danielle, one of the things that I've learned over the years of not being a pet owner from all of you and other people, but as we do these segments, but about medication, sometimes people can use human medications or you know, that passes. That kind of surprises me. But let's talk about the over-the-counter remedies. Are any of them recommended for pets with eye disease?
Sometimes, believe it or not, but there are some relatively rare eye conditions, you know, where exposure to sunlight can make the eyes worse. We sometimes recommend that pets who have conditions that are, you know, worse in sunlight wear goggles, you know, when they're outside to prevent the eyes from being exposed to UV light. And, you know, at the office, we always laugh and call these things doggles because it's funny.
Doggles.
A condition with a long name that we shorten to the letters KCS, you know, causes a lack of tear production in dogs. Among other prescription things, your vet might recommend you apply over-the-counter lubricating ointments to your dog's eyes to prevent the corneas from drying out. And, you know, and that'll help to prevent all the secondary pain and eye damage that comes with that problem. Tear stain remover solutions and eye wipes are also available over the counter and online. And so, you know, basically you should follow your pet's advice, you know, or sorry, your vet's advice. I'm sure your pet probably
your pet
has advice
saying, don't
too.
Put that light in my eye. No, don't put that in my eye. Don't do those little drop things. Bloop.
That's exactly what your pets will say. So I'll revamp that and say, don't follow your pet's advice. follow your vet's advice for when it is appropriate, you know, to use any over-the-counter products. And of course, we always have to be mindful that, you know, what we put in or near your dog's eyes, you know, we don't want to put anything in that's going to damage them or cause pain. So products that are not meant for eyes really shouldn't be used in the eyes or near them unless your vet tells you otherwise.
Wow, there's a lot to consider, especially when you were talking about the eye, the tear track condition.
Yep.
I can't remember what it's called, but that I had never even considered being a thing. But you know, it comes with its own line of products now. So interesting.
Yeah. Well, and like I say, it's usually small breed dogs or dogs with the flat faces. And of course, when they have white fur, it's even more noticeable, right? Yeah. Because you see those rusty stains more easily.
Yeah, exactly. Danielle, thank you very much.
You are so welcome.
All right, we'll chat next week. Dr. Danielle Jonkind joins us for Ask a Veterinarian, and that's every Tuesday on Kelly and Rumia. Every other Tuesday, we get into wellness and health with Francis Wong, and we're going to talk about work-life balance, which is a well-worn phrase that means a little different for each of us, and we'll talk about that in context with burnout as well. She's going to tell us how we can spot the signs early. We'll be right back. It's Kelly and Rumia. Back, it's Kelly and Rumia. Thanks for sticking around here on a Tuesday edition of the show with Kelly McDonald and Rumia Amuthan. We talked about conjunctivitis over the Ask a Vet conversation with Danielle Jonkind just before the break, and that reminded me of kennel cough and all these other ways that, you know, you take your dog to a dog park, they're all socializing, and you don't really know what you're signing up for and what is potentially going to be spread, Kels. And she said it, and I agree. It's just like kids and daycare and school, right?
So that's the only thing I think about. And back in the days when people had things like chickenpox and that running around, and if you caught it, you know, a lot of parents would say, well, I'll bring her over here so my kids can catch it so we're done with it.
Actually, that's true, too. I remember that vividly when we were kids, just everybody kind of keeping tabs on who's got the chickenpox in the neighborhood and in the community. Wow.
Who has had it and who hasn't.
Pretty terrible. Yeah.
Good grief, you know, let's just invite it in, you know, why not? We've got cookies out, call it in.
How about some of the parents who'd never gotten chickenpox? I don't think they want to.
Most of them didn't realize until, oh, shoot.
Yeah, it's way worse than as an adult, I'm hearing.
For sure. Well, speaking of taking care of ourselves, let's chat a little bit about the world of health and wellness with Francis Wong.
Hello, I'm Francis Wong, and I invite you to join me as we explore topics of health and wellness so that you can make the best choices for you to live an informed and radiant life.
Our world seems to be moving faster and faster. And we're just so busy trying to do so many things that sometimes it's hard to stop and take that breather we need. Francis, welcome back to the show. And one of the phrases we hear tossed around all the time is work-life balance. But how often is this actually put into practice? And Francis, what is the outcome of an unbalanced lifestyle?
Thanks, Kelly. Yes, sometimes we don't even know that we need to take a breather because we don't have time to think, but it is so important that we have that break. And while work-life balance is important, I want to highlight that it's not just work-life that can cause burnout. There can be a variety of factors ranging from taking care of elderly parents to running your own business and a lot of other possibilities in between.
So can we start with the definition of burnout then?
Sure. So that's a good place to start. It's important to note that burnout is not considered a medical condition. However, by not addressing it, it can lead to other medical conditions. According to the 11th revision of the International Classification of Diseases, or ICD-11, it's an occupational phenomenon. Burnout is a syndrome conceptualized as resulting from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. It's characterized by three dimensions: feelings of energy depletion or exhaustion, increased mental distance from one's job, or feelings of negativism or cynicism related to one's job, and reduced professional efficacy, probably personal as well.
Yeah.
I disagree with this definition. I think that people who don't have a profession can still be burnt out. What if you're a stay-at-home parent? Yeah, with three small children. I mean, that's a full-time job, but you just don't get paid for it. And you can still easily get exhausted from taking care of three little ones. So today, when I mention work or a job, I'm referring to the task in general that someone is doing, whether it's a full-time job that's paid or it's full-time caregiving. I agree more with the definition by the APA Dictionary of Psychology, which defines burnout as physical, emotional, or mental exhaustion accompanied by decreased motivation, lowered performance, and negative attitudes towards oneself and others. It results from performing at a high level until stress and tension, from extreme and prolonged physical or mental exertion or an overburdening workload take their toll. That's a mouthful. So while end of the year burnout is quite common, personally, I find the stretch from the new year into springtime to be the most difficult. At the end of the year, there are holiday parties and gatherings to look forward to. And let's not forget the short break we get with several statutory holidays in between. But the stretch from new year to spring is kind of that waiting period for summer where we kind of have cold and dreary weather outside. And there's a bit of a gap in holidays. So, I mean, think about it. Even bears don't want to deal with it and they hibernate through winter.
Yeah, I'm going to sleep through this boring time. Yeah, I think the end of the year just seems to give you that wind up of, hey, got through another one. Then you start up the hill again. And some people don't even have the family day, whether if you think about work, if you're a volunteer, it's a heavy duty time. And just taking care of, as you mentioned, the home. I think also, Frances, so many of us judge what we think is, well, you shouldn't be that burned out or tired. Well, you're not doing enough. That's not up to anybody. We all have our own levels and we're in charge of that and doing the best we can and coping the best we can. But you did mention taking care of others, like children or elderly parents, as well as working a lot as possible causes of burnout. What are some of the other causes of burnout?
So as we just discussed, burnout doesn't apply to work anymore. In this case, life factors can also contribute to burnout. And these things include such things as unmanageable workloads, pressures of deadlines, and that could be something like rushing around to take someone to medical appointment after medical appointment, maybe too much work and not enough time to decompress, and spending so much time taking care of other people's needs that we don't have enough time to get our own stuff done. We definitely need timeouts. So taking a day off here or there for a breather is something that we can strive for. And sometimes this isn't possible, especially if there's a lack of support. Say you're the only child and you have siblings, but they're far away. So the responsibility of taking care of elderly parents falls on you. And I'll also add that it could be your own personality traits that are a hindrance and contributing factor. So if you're someone who is a perfectionist and always needing to be in control, that could potentially lead to burnout. So what you said, Kelly, like everyone's limitations are slightly different. Right. So it's important to recognize if those are tendencies that you have and the importance of letting go so that the job or the work is done, even if it's not to your liking or standard of 100%.
So can we talk about, because we've kind of went over what burnout is, all the different ways that it can be caused, and we started getting into the personality traits. But what are some signs of burnout, and are there different kinds of it? Because we're not just talking about work.
Yes. So just as you don't get fat from eating one French fry, burnout doesn't happen overnight. You kind of have to keep an eye for some of the signs so that it just doesn't sneak up on you. One of the signs includes the feeling of exhaustion or feeling tired to the point you're drained and unable to deal emotionally with problems around you. And this applies both again to your professional and personal life. Another sign is the lack of enthusiasm or feelings of negativity towards your job. And another sign is the inability to perform your job or your work, as it can be hard to concentrate or handle your responsibilities. There are also mental burnout symptoms, such as feeling like a sense of failure, losing your sense of purpose, and feeling dissatisfied and incapable. Now, physical burnout symptoms can include a lot of fatigue and a lack of energy, maybe even getting sick more often, having headaches or insomnia, or losing your appetite. These are just a few symptoms, so you have to take a look at the whole picture. Just because you can't sleep at night doesn't magically equate to you being burned out. And then there are four types of burnout, but I think that the most common type is overload burnout, where someone is overloaded and working harder and harder to stay on top of things or trying extra hard in their pursuit of excellence. The second type of burnout is under-challenged burnout. And in this case, the person may be feeling underappreciated or bored at their job. Maybe the person isn't given the opportunities for learning or professional growth, and as a result, the person feels quite bored with their work. Neglect burnout is the third type of burnout, and this is when a person feels helpless, like they're not competent at their job or able to keep up with their job duties. This can be connected to imposter syndrome, where the person doubts their abilities or talents. And the last type of burnout is habitual burnout. And this is considered the most serious phase of burnout, where the person's behavior changes and the mental and physical fatigue is chronic. In some cases, the person may become depressed and possibly suicidal. So it is critical to seek help if you're at this stage.
Okay. You mentioned that burnout can feel like some symptoms of stress, however. So how does stress differ from burnout, or are they the same thing?
So prolonged and excessive stress can lead to burnout, but they aren't quite the same thing. They're almost the opposite. Stress is too much. So too much mental and physical pressure, too much demand on your energy, and too much demand on your time. Burnout, on the other end, is too little motivation, emotion, or care. Like Alicia Yardley said on the employment segment last year, burnout is when your tank is empty. So the person feels depleted and used up.
Yeah. Okay, so what are some ways that we can cope either before we get burnout, because we're now cognizant after listening to this, or once we've hit rock bottom?
Well, let's hope that we can cope before we hit that wall, so to speak. Yeah. If we're able to take breaks, like a day off, or switch out caregiver duties with someone else, then we should do so to remove ourselves from the situation, at least temporarily. Wayne Dyer used to say, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. So I think that if we are in a situation where we cannot get away, we can at least reframe it and view it from a positive lens. For example, instead of thinking, oh, I have to take my child to yet another sports practice, we can think, I'm so lucky that I get to take my child to these activities. Because let's face it, life is short. All the situations are temporary. And in the blink of an eye, your children will be grown up and then you'll be missing the good old days. And of course, it's important to maintain a healthy diet and regular exercise to help with regulating our mood. Engage with friends and family, disconnect from technology, get outside, and consider setting some new priorities and goals. Reevaluate what is really important in your life and make some changes to the way you're living. And while if you still find yourself not coping, seek professional help through your medical provider. And if you work for a large company, some actually will have an employee assistance program that you can take advantage of for your well-being.
It's interesting, Frances, when we think of being overwhelmed, just having too much that we're taking on, dividing ourselves into too many places. It's interesting because you kind of grab onto that one, you understand that one. But that other one that's, I don't want to call it the sneaky one or the silent one, but maybe it's more so. I've talked to more people who are just spend their workday, doing nothing. They don't have enough to do. They feel like, what am I here for? People who may not be going out as much because they're at home, whether it's finances, whatever, that keeps them being there. And again, that kind of, there's got to be more to life than this at either end of the stick when you talk about these kinds of things. And it's so sneaky because you say to people, geez, I don't have enough to do at home, or I don't have to, well, I'll just find something to do. And as so much is supposed to come along with that, that it's so easy to turn it on and off. But with that becomes such an unhappiness. What should I be doing? Is there more? And that's a different kind of pressure put on oneself.
Absolutely. I think that burnout is more of a symptom of society today. You know, a lot of companies like to, you know, everyone's looking at the bottom line and savings. So, you know, trying to get trim with their workforce. So you have more people, less people actually doing more work. So that is where the chances of burnout are happening. But yes, we would have to also look at it from the other angle. Are people being motivated? Do they have enough work to do to keep them engaged? So that's a different conversation. But both ends are important for sure.
Yeah. Well, I like to see at workplaces the ability now of personal days without having to say, almost feel like you have to explain how come you need it. A lot of us talk more about the mental health piece of it. I just need a break. I just want to sit home and play a video game. I want to go for a long walk or a hike on a day where there's less stress for me or when I most feel I need it. And I think we're getting it, whether companies are doing it just because it's the right thing to do, or there are HR departments and companies that say, you betcha, because, you know, the better you feel, the better things work for you overall, but here too. Absolutely. Thanks, Frances.
Thank you.
Wow, great topic. Really interesting. If you missed any of that, please check it out via our podcast. Frances Wong joins us biweekly to talk wellness opposite our nutrition segment with Julia Karanchis.
When we get back, we're going to be speaking to and getting to know Anthony Frazina, author, public speaker, and the founder of the accessibility consulting business Above and Beyond. That's going to be an interesting conversation. So stick around. We'll be back right after the break. Thanks for hanging out with us. We are here with you starting at 2 p.m. Eastern time on AMI TV. It's Kelly and Ramia. Let's get into a conversation with a public speaker and author and the founder of Above and Beyond. Anthony Frazina is here on the show now. So Above and Beyond is an accessibility consulting a company that provides consulting in accessibility services to change attitudes and barriers related to access and inclusion. So it's going to be an interesting conversation. Anthony, thank you for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So tell us about, I mean, I just gave a bit of a snippet of what Above and Beyond is, but tell us about exactly what it is and what you do.
Yeah, Above and Beyond was created in honor of my mother who passed away in 2016, and it started when I wrote a book and started to write a book in 2016 and got it published in 2021. And never in my wildest dreams did I ever envision the acceptance of what the book would have. And then further to that, I started posting a show on our local TV station here on Cable 14 of the same name, and really just took off from there. We're in our fifth season now, and it's just been an incredible experience to hopefully eradicate the attitudinal barriers and perceptions of what disability looks like and give lived experience to disability within our communities.
Anthony, I'm always amazed when we talk about taking something like a book, something that we've done, and Fedora's off to you, of course, with the, honoring your mom this way. I'm sure she's very proud. And, you know, wherever she is, she's looking down and saying, hey, this is wonderful. Tell us about putting a show together, getting to a fifth season, and for you, when you started out, moved it along, is it much the same? Did you change a lot? And how come? Fill us in so those of us outside of the viewing area might get some idea of what you do in that capacity, especially others that might feel very inspired.
Absolutely. So the show is through Cable 14 here in Hamilton. Thanks to Bill Custer, Jonathan Friedman, Harmony McKenzie, Travis Blackwell, and everybody that helped me along the way learn what it was like to put together a TV show, you know, building the content, building the community relationships. You know, I've had the opportunity to interview people like David Onley, David Lepofsky, and having a lot of conversations about things that I don't even necessarily have that full grip on, you know, intangible disabilities, invisible disabilities, hidden disabilities. But bringing that message out there about the importance of accessibility and inclusion, giving it to the forefront of the conversation rather being considered an afterthought, was something that's been really important to me.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What a way to learn about all of those things, especially And I think we find ourselves in that very privileged position here because we learn a lot. We can't know everything, and certainly we can't walk in everyone's shoes. We can just do our best to understand.
Absolutely.
So tell us more about the kinds of speaking engagements you take part in.
Absolutely. So I've been hired in the past by Bimbo Canada, which is Canada's largest bakery, Hydrocephalus Canada, Amazon has hired me on to be a panelist with regards to speaking on technology and accessibility and the importance of bridging the gap to accessibility and inclusion by way of, you know, cost versus rationale, bridging that gap to things like within the communities that allow people with disabilities to thrive. I'm also the volunteer director of media relations for the Ontario Disability Coalition. So I've spoken to Queen's Park on a plethora of occasions, hosted events, hosted rallies for things like, you know, upping ODSP, for example, and the need for people with disabilities to be in a space where disability is an opportunity to take it to the next level.
Right. I know, Anthony, a lot of time we get asked to do a talk and there's a different purpose for each one, a different reason you're being invited. But when you look at the overall impact of your public speaking, whether it's the targets you want to hit when doing a talk or the outcome for that person who's listening, what do you think that might be?
That is a wonderful question. I think the outcome for the community and the speaking engagements that I've done really is just about changing the culture, changing the mindsets of people with disability, you know, before seeing me and having that talk with them in their community. And then afterwards, you know, looking at things from a different lens and looking at things from a lived experience point of view, rather than a legislation that only meets certain criteria and it's not really policed, or things like, you know, legislation leading itself to a minimum standard or compliance. And not all compliance necessarily meets the needs of people with disabilities. So it's changing that culture, that set.
It sounds empowering, too, in the sense of you're there to educate how someone might want to do something, not necessarily be up there at the front of the line advocating like some of the, you know, speakers you've mentioned that you've had on the show, but really teaching me how, what I should think about, what I should know.
Absolutely. You know, it's disability is different for everybody. And I always say that when you've met one person with a disability, you've met one person with a disability. And in Hamilton, the percentage of people with disabilities at 28% is greater than the provincial and national averages. And I look at that stat and I look at it as an abundance and I look at it as an asset. Because when you talk about lived experience and when you talk about disability in earnest, you know, that's where we can really change the culture and how it looks for people all across Ontario, Canada, not just people with disabilities, but people without disabilities, and seeing the empowering work that when we work together as allies, we could really make the world a better, the best place to live, work, and play inclusively.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a collaborative mindset. I think that predominantly, you know, a lot of us feel that way, right? There's the education, and sometimes you really got to put the hammer down with legislation and other ways, but an advocacy can get really tough. But at the end of the day, really all of us have to collaborate in order to make anything substantial happen, especially attitudinally. So let's talk about the physical barriers for a second. How do you work to remove physical barriers in buildings and parking lots? You've done some work this way as well.
Yeah, I'm also with the Forward Movement, and we're changing the culture and the mindset by way of the Forward Movement's dynamic symbol rather than the universal symbol of accessibility. But when it comes to a physical mindset and a physical structure, it's not okay that people with disabilities and who use mobility devices can only enter and exit a building. What does that building have to offer? Mm-hmm. Are the washrooms accessible? Is the community that that building serves accessible for people who have different disabilities outside of mine? Looking at it from the point of view, of being proactive rather than reactive, and looking at it as an investment rather than a cost. You know, there's this whole semblance of being around in our community. If you're not accessible, a lot of people with disabilities are not going to go. But if you look at it more so and you provide more accessibility and from that lived experience, you're going to get more of an end result.
Right. Yeah, so true. It's very interesting when you look at it that way, Anthony, and kind of, you know, say, hey, this is what we're what we feel here. This is what to explore. When you talk about our attitudes and, you know, perceptions, where would you like to say to people when they ask you, what if those of us who are disabled, where do we need to kind of change our attitude?
I think it comes down to, you know, people with disabilities being in more empowering roles, you know, listening to us and with us with intention rather than obligation, you know, dismissing us in a community is really a non-starter for me. You know, giving that place and that platform to be able to produce quality work within the brand that I've created within the community is really important. And understanding disability as a whole is where we can move forward.
And I guess that there's a lot of different levels to it, right, Anthony? There's, you know, what we do individually, what we do as a group, where we take the knowledge that we have and how we express that and who takes part in that way. So are there any kind of upcoming things that you want to shout out that you're looking forward to take part in, or any unique opportunities that you've had in terms of advocacy?
I've had a lot of wonderful experiences, you know, having written the book, doing a lot of commercials where lived experience of disability is part of the commercial. You know, the city of Toronto has actually hired me to be part of their construction zone and traffic management teams to ensure that we're treating our community and our people with disabilities as people and treating them the right way, as we all deserve to be treated.
Awesome. Anthony, can we talk just a little bit more about what services of Above and Beyond kind of offer up and what you'd like to draw some attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's, you know, giving that lived experience of disability to be more prevalent in our community. You know, there's things that are done that are not necessarily done correctly and that, you know, lends itself to a further investment and a further cost. But with Above and Beyond, we really try to get there, and we try to get there early so that we can put together the framework and the idea so that it's done and it's done right to and for everybody to enjoy.
And that's amazing. You have any mentorship, you know, either formally or informally, where you know, offer your guidance or perspectives on how to advocate?
Yeah, absolutely. I've gone to hundreds of schools, whether it be virtually, whether it be in person here in Hamilton. I've spoken on, you know, plenty of stages. And I think the best advice that I can give people is to simply, you know, listen with intention rather than obligation. And it's okay to invest the money now because it will return itself in spades at the end.
Mm-hmm.
What is the question you get at? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, because my question was going to be, what's one of the most challenging things to get people on board with? And I think money speaks volumes.
Absolutely. Because there's not a level of understanding of what that money can return itself at the end. And if you look at, you know, whether you're building a meeting, whether you're putting together a building, look at the accessibility from lived experience. It's not okay just to meet a benchmark, a building code, because the building code, again, lends itself to a minimum standard and lends itself to be compliant. And when you're compliant, you're not meeting the needs of people with disabilities. And that's where the lived experience component really comes in.
Yeah, take it further. Anthony, if people have questions, those of us in our communities and saying, hey, you know, how should I deal with this challenge or things like that, or if someone would like you for a speaking engagement, where can they find you? Where can they go to learn more?
Thank you so much. Yeah, they can go to anthonyferzina.ca or by email at aboveandbeyond.anthony@gmail.com.
Well, it was really lovely having you on the show, Anthony. Any next steps for Above and Beyond that you want to quickly tell us about?
Yeah, again, next steps is, you know, my my engagement with the City of Toronto, being part of the construction zone initiative and the traffic agents, bringing more awareness to accessibility and inclusion. I'm also going to be part of a destination college at the end of May as well, teaching our youth about what accessibility looks like. And when we bring inclusion together, we all prosper.
Okay.
Okay. Anthony, also, Channel 14, Hamilton area, when do people find it? How? When are you on the air?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So it's Cable 14, cable14.com. There's a watch live button on the main screen, Mondays at 9 p.m.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We were speaking with Anthony Frazina, founder of Above and Beyond, about the services that this organization offers, and of course, a lot of the work that he does in general for advocacy for people with disabilities. Stick around for the second hour of Kelly and Ramia. We have a Voices conversation with Andy Frank. He's the manager of AMI Audio, and we're inviting him onto the soapbox to talk about all things that he cares about. Also, Young Wang is going to share her story about hosting a culturally authentic dining experience for her blind women's group in Toronto. And up next, community reporter Julie Martin is giving us all of what's going on in Pictacani, Nova Scotia. We'll be right back.
Keep it here for more of Kelly and Ramya on AMI TV.
Kicking off hour two of Kelly and Ramya. It's the Tuesday edition, and we love hanging out for 2 hours here as we do every weekday because it comes with a variety of conversation, guests, contributors, and of course, a lot of learning. Kelly McDonald and Ramya Amuthan, we're the hosts of today's show.
And we, Monday through Wednesday on the program, visit to begin our second hour with our community reporters. Fantastic time we spend with them because we get to know a lot about what's going on. We check in with them thrice a week, as mentioned here on the program. Today, let's find out what's going on in the low vision and blind community in Pictou County, Nova Scotia. Community reporter Julie Martin joining us. Julie, welcome back.
Good afternoon. How are you?
All right, but it's time for us to settle back, Julie, and put you to work. But I see where the first thing is not necessarily work, but you could march all over Nova Scotia here, according to this. Weekly walks all over Nova Scotia. What's this about?
Yes.
Sounds good.
So this, it is. It's very good. So this is through, Hike Nova Scotia, and it's Nova Scotia Walks. There are weekly walks in every community across Nova Scotia where volunteers from Hike Nova Scotia lead very gentle walks around the community. For example, the one in New Glasgow here, they walk around the Jitney Trail, the Sampson Trail, which runs along the river. They ensure that all walks are as accessible as possible. They have sighted guides, which is a program that did start here in Pictou County before COVID, and Hike Nova Scotia picked up on it right away and ensured that there were sighted guides for these walks all across Nova Scotia. And like I said, they're just gentle walks. It's about just going out, going for a stroll, but meeting new people, other people in your community. And it's not just the gentle exercise. It's what it does for your mental health and your socialization. And I think that, especially here, I don't know about other places, but there's still a lot of isolation as that residual from COVID, unfortunately. So, you know, it's springtime. It's time to start getting outside and enjoying the fresh air. And, you know, you're walking with somebody that can describe what's going on around you, and you get all those beautiful smells of spring. And, you know, we had deer in the yard the other day eating my plants already. But spring's here, you know?
Yeah. And that's really nice. I love the idea of the walks too, to talk to different people, to learn maybe something.
Yes.
Maybe something somebody does interests you, a hobby, an interest. But the easy, casual walk. Now, the guiding kind of interests me. So, let me get this right. Is the organization that was started to teach people how to guide?
No, what we did in Pictou County here was we talked about having sighted guides. So those of us that didn't have a guide to go walking or hiking or snowshoeing. So Pictou County Parks and Recreation, Claire Steele took the torch on that one and ran with it. And not only did they train guides, they ensured that there were different tips for the canes, for our canes, for different terrains. And they have the Nordic walking poles because sometimes you just want the stability. You don't necessarily need the cane because you have a sided guide.
But I love that, Julie, about the training. I love that about the train because, you know, I don't think anyone really thinks about that. Oh, I'll just teach them. I'll hang off their elbow. But there's such a security if you're properly trained. You don't have some of the other things in, as a guide. We don't understand the stress that a guide might feel that, well, I don't want this person to trip on my watch or whatever because they don't know. You know, it doesn't mean we're incompetent or they think we are. It's, well, geez, I don't want to cause a problem or do the wrong thing. So fedora's off. That's a really fantastic thing. I've never heard of that.
Well, and it's things like, you know, I'm tall. I'm 5'11". So I worry about little branches or signs or so it's nice to have a guide that understands that. But more importantly for me, it's how they narrate the scenery as I'm walking, you know, how they tell me what's around and describe it to me. And it just fills in the blanks and it's just lovely. But before I forget, May 8th is Nova Scotia Walks Day. I usually do the walk every year with my local library, but there's events again in every community. And I think it's around 1 o'clock or 1:30 usually. You see all the different community groups out walking. And that is our national walk day to encourage people to get outside and enjoy.
I love it. A lot of good intention, Julie. Let's talk about the very unique tactile mural that's coming to the CNIB office.
Yes, it's up now. Sarah Moja is the artist that was commissioned to do this work. And I mean, she's just one of my favorite people in the world. She really makes my heart beam. She's the artist that started the tactile art group that we started just before COVID. And she still, to this day, continues. She travels from Halifax once a month and still does this group with us. Now the library is taking it on, so they get funding for that. Sarah herself is visually impaired, and she's very much about tactile art, and she's a huge advocate for art being accessible for all. So this mural is... You normally would think of a mural as being a painted something on a wall, but this is out of wood. It's depicting the journey from sight loss through Vision Loss Rehabilitation Center, through the CNIB, and it depicts a man with a guide dog, and these are all wooden, so they're tactile, you can feel them. On this path, and behind him are the tracks, his footprints and the paw prints. And then there's a lady in a wheelchair that's using her cane. So she's behind her are the tracks of the wheels and the swish of the cane because she's swishing, you know, that kind of swipe thing.
Right.
Forgotten what it's sweeping. Called. You know what I mean? Yeah, thanks. And then there's a little girl that is also using a cane and doing the sweeping motion, but she's skipping. So her tracks are very like all over the place because she's dancing along this journey. Mm. So what it's depicting is that we're all on the same road. It's all the same journey, no matter how we come to this road. Whether it's from an accident, disease, genetics, whatever. But we all are going down the same road, whether it's, and we all go through those stages of grief to get to the other end of the road and come out with But as we're doing this, we're also leaving tracks for others behind us that are going through a similar path on this journey. So I just love the depiction of it all. The tracks are painted, but they're very high contrast paint and it's quite large. Mm-hmm. So it's right there at the CNIB office. If you're in Halifax, please go check it out. It's nice. It's meant to be touched. It's meant to be enjoyed and it's just beautiful. And I'm so proud of her. She's done an amazing job. It's a great depiction. Yeah.
I like the idea of the tracks just because we go through life and maybe we can show something, maybe we can make something easier. Maybe it's just that whole being able to identify with somebody else, whether it's that person ahead of us or the person coming behind us, that maybe those tracks make life simpler. I'm tapping my toe because we're talking Caledonian Orchestra next. This is an afternoon of toe tapping entertainment.
May 5th, Glasgow Square, the Caledonian Orchestra of Nova Scotia will be performing at 2:30. I didn't turn the page. I'm sorry. I can't remember if it's 2:30 or 1:30. I think it's 2:30. I'll find it. It's, like you said, it's toe tapping. They bring old Scottish music to Nova Scotia. There's jigs, reels, waltzes, marches. They're being joined by vocal artists. Oh, I'm so sorry. I just kicked the table. They're being joined by local vocal artists. I believe there's one of the Scottish Highland dancers are going to be performing. It's $20 a ticket, and it is at 2:30 p.m. Yes.
This is nice.
Sunday, May 5th.
They got a little bit of everything.
Yeah, and I love when you said the toe tapping, because at first you see orchestra and you're, I want to make a funny here, but am I going to be correct? And that's really cool. And again, some of it's the stereotype of the area. And you think, okay, toe tapping, that's really tremendous. Yeah. Nice list of variety of music, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's so enjoyable. It really gets you in the mood. And spring's here. You know,
yes.
The more we can do to get that upbeat feeling, the better.
Get out there and fiddle around.
Get out there and fiddle around. Yeah, you got that right. So while you're walking.
And talking. Is this your kind of music, Julie?
I do love it. Yes, I do. I like a whole genre of different musics, music. but I do like the toe tapping stuff. Yeah, I really do. Yeah, but I like classical as well. I like doing clean my house with classical music on.
And focus music.
Go for her walk, watch out for the low-hanging tree branches.
Yeah.
Right?
Don't trip over anything.
Julie, of course, absolutely wonderful stuff. And what a wonderful, nice spring feel. Thank you.
Thank you so much, guys. Take care.
Talk to you next month. May.
Yes, bye.
Wow.
Yes. Oof,
boy, bye. Some great stuff then, I'm sure. Julie Martin, our community reporter in Pictou County, Nova Scotia. And we do these community reports. Once a month, we talk to each of these individuals who bring us delightful stuff like this. And we do that Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. See, I'm starting to catch you guys. This is the S's. Now I'm doing it Wednesdays. We do that 3 times a week with them to kick off the second hour of the program, that visit with our community reporters.
We didn't get to any dining as part of the community report, but...
Well, she knows to cut that out with us.
That's right.
Everybody knows. I'm not going to fall for those two and their food nonsense.
Except for Young. I don't think she's got the message, because after the break...
Making up for it.
Yeah, Young Wong is going to talk about Chinese dining culture, where dishes are designed to be shared among everyone at the table.
What was that filthy word? Shared?
I know. She hosted a culturally authentic Chinese dining experience for her blind women's group in Toronto at Asian Legends. Nice. So we're going to find out how that went after the break on Kelly and Rumia. Welcome back. Thanks for tuning in. It's Kelly and Ramya on AMI TV, AMI Audio, and wherever you love to listen to your favorite podcasts. Let's talk a little food, because now over the break, we just talked about French fries and everything else. My goodness, just the talk of talking about food is enough to get us talking about food. Let's bring on Young Wang, our freelance reporter.
Hi, I'm Young Wang. I'm a blogger, disability advocate, and immigrant social innovator. Join me to explore challenges and changes in our community on Kelly and Ramya.
Young, this is really a cool conversation based on an experience you had. And the essence of it is you want to share tips on how to order food at Chinese restaurants. So where is it all coming from?
It came from a eating out event I organized last month. Mm-hmm. We have this blind women's group, a very good group. In the group, each member takes turns to organize an outing, usually to a restaurant of their choice. So last month, it was my turn. So I invited members to come to Scarborough, to a very good Chinese restaurant. That was on the St. Patrick's Day. Mm. It was a little bit travel for many members who live in downtown area or in the West End. But there are lots of authentic Chinese restaurants in Scarborough. And, wow. Yeah, and hey,
I'm kind of curious when you talk about making the choice where you're going to go and the authenticness, and I'm sure there's some bravery in the group because obviously every place you go to, it, whether as authentic as it might be, you know, somebody might not like something, and that's okay. So you guys sound like an adventurous kind of group, but is there a particular thing that you would tell an audience member listening in to know who says, you know, I'd really like to try that authentic, what do I look for?
Yeah, so that's the Chinese restaurant I like. So I think that gives some
hint. That's good enough.
authenticity. And Scarborough is heavily Chinese populated. Right? So there's supposed to be a lot of authentic Chinese restaurants here. But some people, they would hesitate to come because it's too far away for them. But I would encourage, like, if you want to have really like a good Chinese restaurant that Chinese like, then probably it's worth the traveling. And that's how much people in Scarborough every day travel to work in downtown or
that's
in the
right.
East End. How much time
we do the most
on the road, right? Every day. So help us to get the subway lines extended to this end of the city.
Toronto's been a bit stubborn.
PSA. It's a public service.
Yeah, Toronto has been very stubborn at putting the subway out that far.
I mean,
must be the rock underneath Scarborough.
Scarborough
make it
is
hard.
Incredible for authentic cuisines, though. Just, you know, all kinds of cuisines, little hole in the walls, not even always big sit-down restaurants, but there's a lot of good cuisine here. So what is it? What is it like to dine authentically at a Chinese restaurant? Tell us.
So in a Chinese restaurant, and they actually at the table in each family life, a dish is always designed to be shared. So in a Chinese restaurant, when Chinese gather in the Chinese restaurant, they order together. Yes, you order something you like, but at the same time, you also take into consideration of what other bodies at the table, their choices. So at the end, you together would get a variety of dishes, and usually from these categories, like meat, if you're not vegetarian. That like beef or chicken or fish or shrimp, lamb, you know, that's one category. And it will come like a big portion, all meat in different cooking, right? Like cook in various ways. And another category is vegetable. You order like it comes all vegetable. And the starchy food, that's rice, noodle, or dumpling sometimes, and soup. If you are keen on having some soup, it comes in a big bowl to be shared, usually. Nice. So basically, they are the four main categories. But some people would like some appetizer or a drink or, you know, dessert. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the main course for a Chinese meal, it consists of a variety of dishes from these main four categories. You order, then you get to taste different, a variety of food. Mm-hmm. And from mm-hmm. each category, and they provide balanced nutrition. And usually you share the bill because you order for yourself and for everybody else. So everybody, you know, share the same food and they share the bill. So that's nice. That's how the Chinese would order. And that's the way you get the best out of a Chinese cuisine.
Yeah, it sounds like a way to get a lot of variety, right? And give you experience.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How did the group do managing in there? And again, you guys have done this before. Is there any tips that we should know when, especially taking a group?
Yeah, it's because many times I see people, because it's very different in the Western restaurant. If I, you know, have the right impression, there you order for yourself. You order a steak and it comes in a plate for yourself together with some vegetables and maybe mashed potatoes. Or if you order pasta, it's all belong to you, right? Mm-hmm. If people want to share, they may share. But basically,
right.
It comes in a plate just for you. And it's very individualized and very neat and convenient, I would say, but it's just not the way you would order in a Chinese restaurant if you really want to, you know, like eat authentically. I mean, order authentically. Right. Yeah. Many times I see people come to a Chinese restaurant and they, you know, let's say that's too troublesome because people have different tastes and they probably have allergies or some cultural religious reasons. So some people don't eat pork or beef. Some people don't eat shrimp. And how are we gonna, you know, order something for everybody? Mm-hmm. It's a very demanding task. But I would say, if you would like that takes some willingness to cooperate and it takes a little bit longer time maybe because you don't only order for yourself. You need to take consideration of other choices, to be aware of other choices and intentionally to order varieties,
right.
Not all the same. But people, when they order for themselves, like in their usual way, they often order, like everybody at the table order something from the starchy food group. So say one order, oh, I'd like some rice. The other, oh, I'd like some noodle. So everybody order this starchy food and they don't get to the main course of other categories, meat or vegetables. Mm-hmm. Well, the starchy food, they will come with a little bit of vegetable, or a little bit of meat, but they're just like side dishes. They're not, if you only order this, you only get a very portion, like very small portion of that main course. You don't get the full main course. I always want to encourage people to order like the Chinese, when you're in a Chinese restaurant. Because I was the host, so and my friends, they're very nice. At one point, I said, "Ah, this is too difficult," and you know, I don't mind just order my own stuff.
Yeah.
But I give them gentle portion. Like, try, give it a try, and we can have a lot of varieties. That would be way better. And at last, we did. We managed it. So we ordered chicken fried rice with some eggs and vegetables. We ordered dumplings and seafood noodles. And someone ordered the chicken. So that's just a lemon chicken. And I look at all these and I choose some vegetables because I saw, oh, there were no vegetables. So I ordered from vegetable category. I ordered snow bean leaves and also tofu. So we had five people at the table, and the staff, the restaurant, Asian Legend in Scarborough, their staff were super nice. They explained the menu patiently, and when they served the food, they helped us. So they, get the portion onto everybody's plate. Mm-hmm. And whenever they observed, whenever your plate was empty, they would come up and ask you, like, what else would you like? So that was very nice. Helpful. Mm-hmm, very nice.
And how did that contribute, Young, to the mm-hmm. concept of tipping then? Because you mentioned the staff and you mentioned, you know, everybody splitting or collaboratively ordering and eating together. So the intention is that we're all doing this as a big group thing. So how does it work? Or is there some cultural significance when it comes to the bill and to the gratuity?
So usually people live with 15%, 20% tip, right? Mm-hmm. And at the end, because every one of us was very happy with the food, they were delicious, and the waiters, they were really nice. So we decided together that we wanted to give a 20% tip. That's what we did. So all the dishes, there was a cost, and add on that 20% the tip, and all together, and we split evenly between the five of us. And so including all the dishes and the drinks and the tea and, the service, everybody paid $29 something. So less than $30 each person for a really enjoyable dinner.
And a lot of food, and certainly enough food. Wow. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it was beautiful.
Variety of food.
Wow.
Yeah. So everybody was happy.
Young, thank you so much for this. Not only are we all hungry now, but we've shouted out Scarborough so everyone can visit for lots of great food options and cuisine.
Yeah, welcome to Scarborough.
Uh-huh. But very insightful, and I'm glad that it was a successful outing for your group. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We'll chat next month. We were speaking with our freelance reporter. She's also a blogger, a writer, and her name is Young Wang. You can catch these segments on the third Tuesday of every month. As well, you can catch Voices on the third Tuesday of every month, where we bring a person on and they can hop up on the soapbox and talk about whatever they'd like to. So this month, we invite Andy Frank, who is the manager of AMI Audio, and he's going to tell us about a lot of things AMI, including some remotes and upcoming events, as well as formulas for creating good podcasts. We'll be right back. It's Kelly and Rumia. I've actually been really enjoying the kind of family style aspect of sharing food, Kels. So everybody orders, but everybody shares a little bit of everything. We missed that during the pandemic. Now it seems like we're able to experience it a little bit more. We just came out of a conversation about eating Chinese food in an authentic way with Young Wang. So it got me thinking, like, I never thought about it really formally, but with my family, it's always like that as well. We just order a little bit of everything and everybody tries it.
I think it gets tough in groups sometimes, especially if you don't know some of the people. Well, family's one thing. Or if you're getting unlimited, like refills on stuff, people seem more okay because they're afraid. Well, what if I only like a certain part of it, but we're all supposed to eat kind of an equal share of the things, and there's plates or things I don't really want, but other things I love. I think there's a fear that especially North Americans have when it comes to food, and you get that in your head, and being blind, you don't know. So I find that's kind of where I'd prefer not necessarily to share, and I'd like to pretend it's not just out of the Kelly greed, but I'll analyze that still, try to determine that answer. Folks, on our Voices segment, we like to hear about your passion drives and any comments that you might find important that you want to share with us. Andy Frank is the manager of AMI Audio, and he's stepping up to the soapbox today. And this is a little bit of a diversion from what we've been doing lately, reaching out to folks that we've had on the program for a number of years and kind of getting them on into our Voices segment. But I always enjoy Andy getting in at this time of the year for multiple reasons and some of the things that we'll go over here today on the program. Last year you joined us and at one point gave us an incredible description of the outfield area at the Rogers Center, but particularly going in and the experience of ordering food and stuff like that. I don't know if you've had a chance to get down there yet, but if you have, great. Otherwise, I'm kind of curious quickly as a fan of the team and someone who is very observant, what have you noticed, what you see with the new phase two work that was done in those renovations at Rogers Center in Toronto for the Blue Jays?
Well, it's great to be back, first of all, Kelly. And no, I have not been to the Rogers Center yet. And I was on StubHub all weekend thinking about it, I have to admit.
Oh, yeah.
But I didn't go yet. And it looks really, really nice. The layout of the lower bowl that I think cost them $1 billion, Kelly, if I'm not mistaken.
I cannot remember. I've heard the number immensely several times, and I can't. With both phases, I mean.
It's in that range. And they basically took out everything in the lower area of the stadium, including underground, the dugouts, the works, and then rebuilt it. And the sight lines are really, really nice because it's designed for baseball, whereas the Rogers Center was designed as a multi-purpose football, basketball, baseball stadium back in 1989. It is now focused on home plate and where the action is. So the seats are shaped and laid out in a different way. Sections are a bit smaller. They're not quite as big and blue generic as they were. They're kind of a gray now, blue-gray. They're more expensive. That is no surprise to anybody. The good news is the upper bowl and the outfield and all that are pretty much the same price as they were last year. So the average plebe like me can still go and sit in the upper bowl and enjoy a game as I've always done. But it does look nice. And they're angling for the All-Star game, Kelly. As you know, that's a big deal. And they're looking hopefully in the next couple of years to get the All-Star game and show off what they've got. So they've done the best they can with that concrete bowl. I really think they've done the absolute best they can.
I hear it's so different looking. And we know in so many other cities, they have two places, a football stadium often next door to a baseball stadium, where most of us were used to say, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? And now we're seeing why the real fans, the people want to enjoy. Plus, we know that under area of Rogers Center you spoke of. I know being down there was like, where am I, man? It's like I was traveling around some planet on a moon somewhere.
Does have the inside of a UFO with anybody's exactly. Stepped inside of a UFO, not that I have recently.
Did you mention the cup holders, Andy?
I did not mention bigger the cup seats. Holders, Rania.
Everybody keeps talking about these new and improved cup holders. They're not getting any description.
So if you're inclined to consume a large quantity of beverages at one of these events, having a cup holder in front of you at your knee versus having to place it down beside your ankle and then have someone kick it is an advantage for sure.
Yeah. Okay. The person in front of you got tired of it pouring down into their pants ahead of you.
That's right. So it's for those who indulge, great. It's a bonus to have cup holders.
Okay. You can stick your hot dogs in there too, I guess.
Sure, and your wrapper is whatever.
Yeah, your mini ones. That might be a little good little garbage can. I like the idea, I must admit, because of spilling. It really is. But okay, Andy, we'll get a report when you first go down there and check it out, because I loved it last time, especially the paying thing. It made me start to think a lot about how would a blind person go in there? How comfortable would we feel paying? And I know that's kind of the model that more things are going to. Want to talk about AMI audio remotes. What's in store, but what's been happening? Andy, it's nice. I think Andy Frank has a budget.
I don't have a Kelly and Ramya show budget, but I do have a budget.
Everybody pull out their spreadsheets.
Yeah. You know us at AMI Audio, we've always, Kelly, going way back in the day when we first met each other at the turn of the century, we've always been able to stretch a penny in this department. And
Yes.
So, but we have been traveling. It's been a lot of fun. Live remotes, for those who don't know that language, it's a community event. We go out and do a broadcast at a community event somewhere in Canada. We get a chance to meet the participants, meet whoever's involved in doing these things. So it's a bit of an outreach thing for AMI, as well as being an actual live broadcast on AMI Audio in audio only. And we've been doing about one a month on average. But some of them sort of collide together, and this weekend is a great example of a collision in Western Canada. We have in Regina, we have the Guide Dog with a Purpose Gala, CNIB, of course, at the Delta Hotel in Regina on Saturday night at 8 p.m. That was initiated by my dear friend Becky Czar, who you all know from a couple of podcasts, The Blind Reality, which she did a couple of years ago. One of our very first made-for-podcasts, and then the Raising Kindness that she did with her son, Bennett, that wrapped up recently as well. And this is basically celebrating and raising money to raise guide dogs in that area, and there's actually going to be a red carpet event, which is my favorite part of this thing.
Wow.
Where the guide dogs are going to be presented on the red carpet. And it's going to be so much fun to see these dogs. And of course, Becky has had a guide dog for a while. And Lulu is her guide dog's name. And it's been a joy to observe their journey over the last few years. So we're going to meet some folks with their guide dogs. We're going to meet some, there's going to be representation from the province of Saskatchewan. The mayor of Saskatchewan is going to be there. A whole bunch of other speakers. And entertainment, all kinds of things. So we like covering these galas from time to time. This is one of those galas that's going to be a lot of fun. Of course, Becky will be there, and so she's co-hosting that thing with me. So that's in Regina on Saturday night, 8 p.m. Eastern time.
Great descriptions, too, of all this. Thank you. You have another one, too, this weekend.
Yeah, so the next day, I'm taking I don't know if it's the opposite of a red eye. I'm taking a 5:30 a.m. flight to Calgary. I didn't even know the airport in Regina was open at that hour, but apparently it is. And we're doing...
I'm trying to come up with the right name for it. The Wheatfield Red Liner. I don't know. Like, sorry, our friends.
The Coffee Express.
That's probably a little better.
My technician, Stan Baba, and I are going to be taking a flight at 5:30 and arriving in Calgary at 10 minutes past 7 a.m. And then 4 hours later, we'll be on the air doing the Junior National Goalball Finals, women's followed by men's. That's going to be at Eastern time. It's going to be 1 p.m. Onward. That's when that event is happening, the Junior National Goalball Finals. Done by Nico Cardarelli, who's been calling Canadian blind hockey tournaments for the last 10 years on AMI and on Parasport TV. And he's calling the finals. This is the first time we've ever attempted to do this. We attempted to do this, Kelly and Remy.
Yeah, before the pandemic, before.
The weekend of the pandemic is where there were the international goalball tournament in Vancouver that we had to cancel. We canceled it on the 12th of March, and then we all went home to work on the 16th. But yeah, we canceled it on the 12th. So this is our second attempt at doing goalball. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we don't have these kinds of results.
That's great. I'm also looking forward to Nico. I didn't know how much, you know, Nico has experience. I mean, I know he's been all over with his Parasport and everything like that, but for goalball coverage, and what a dedicated person too, and a great one to have on our side.
Nico called Games Kelly at your alma mater down at in Brantford. He's done.
Oh, did he?
He's done goal ball. Yeah, that's where he learned. And so we've had to do some tricky stuff to make sure that the court is as quiet as you and Remy both know. A goal ball environment has to be dead silent. And how do you have someone with Nico who can project his voice across the country without the help of a microphone? How do we do that? So we're actually going to have a camera on the court following the ball and so on. And Nico is going to be in another room in the facility at Canada Olympic Park in Calgary, calling the game off of a TV monitor.
So have the audio bow for the ball and everything like that, like the inside.
100%. 100%. Okay. I'm giving you some inside info here.
Good. I love it.
That's the way we're getting around it. I'll bet you they'll still hear him, even with all the doors
probably
closed.
Oh, yeah. Probably. Oh, yeah.
Man, that's like taking a page out of the Toronto Blue Jays radio team. Now, you stay
almost
here in this room.
Almost. You know?
So that's, you know, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask, how many hours is it again for the finals that you're covering?
They're 1 hour each. Mm-hmm. So the women's is going to go at 1:30 Eastern time, and then the men's at 2:30 Eastern time.
Excellent. Yeah. All right, cool. Well, let's talk podcasts because, as you said, you know, podcasts are a big part of AMI audio now. Lots of originals out there, some changes as well, and continuing to develop. You got podcast coordinator Ryan Delahunty moving the whole thing along. So what do you want to say about podcast formulas, Andy?
Well, I didn't know there was going to be math in this interview.
I know, but I did say spreadsheets earlier as a bit of a tease. Yep.
Just don't put the geography in.
There is, if I knew the formula for success for a podcast, I would be a very, very wealthy individual. But I know, you know, I've attended a couple of conferences in the U.S., attended by thousands, and Ryan Delahunty's also attended a couple, because we're learning so much about what makes a good podcast. And the first thing is niche. You want to appeal to an audience that is after a particular, relatively narrow subject. So if your thing is guide dogs, then stay focused on the guide dogs and do nothing but guide dogs. If it's tech, stay with tech. If it's fashion, stay with fashion. The most successful podcasts have a real focus, an audience. They know their audience. They know what it is that they want. And they know that they'll stick with them till the bitter end, as long as they're interested in the subject they're talking about. The second one that's really become obvious in the last couple of years is if you're doing a podcast for the sake of podcasting, you better be on YouTube, because nobody's going to find you if you're not on YouTube. As a discoverability tool, YouTube is hands down the winner more than anything. And I know you might tell me, well, what is YouTube or visual medium? How does that appeal to people who are low vision or blind? Believe me, it hasn't stopped many podcasts from being successful, because again, it's discoverability and using the power of Google's algorithm, the power of Google, which is YouTube, to find things. You know, if you like this, you're going to like that. If you like this, so this whatever, you can't lose by putting stuff up there. And if you're going to go on YouTube, then you have to follow some pretty basic fundamentals of sound, lighting, captions, transcripts, notes, all those things. These are things that my colleague Ryan Delahunty has really done an outstanding job with. If you go and see a podcast like Tripping on Air with Ardra Shepherd, for example, is a glowing example of accessibility within a YouTube podcast. And these are the kinds of things that I think bode well for success if you follow that. So if you know your subject, you stay focused on your subject, you put it in the right place, and you follow the fundamentals of broadcasting, you have a better chance than most of being successful.
Okay. Andy, I that's a wonderful advice. It's tremendous, because I know you guys have gone to those conferences, and that's kind of why I wanted to bring this out today. But also, you've gotten some unique programming that also goes up as podcasts. Anything particular that you'd like to kind of give a nod to today? There's some hype about, this is an obscure podcast that I'm not sure a lot of. I think it's something audio review, books review, audio book review, something to do with that show.
There's a tremendously talented individual who works at AMI. His name is Jacob Szymanski.
Oh, yeah.
And... Agreed.
Tremendous guy. Tremendous. He's been also out on your remotes, too. My good heavens. He's all over the place.
He was in Winnipeg at the Manitoba Accessible Sports Expo a couple of weeks ago and did a tremendous job interviewing all kinds of exhibitors. He is the lead host now and I suppose maybe the lead producer for AMI Audio Book Review. There is Jacob. Yeah, Jay's pictured on the left over there. And Jacob is, of course, Ramya started AMI Audiobook Review a couple of years ago with Nisreen Abdel-Majid, and then Jacob joined the team. I had no idea when I assigned Jacob to take part in this to what extent he was a consumer of this product. He consumes a ton of audiobooks and has a lot to say about them. It's been a wonderful addition to complement Ramya's obvious talents. And I'm very proud of this show. This is a show that recently featured a version, an Audible product, 1984, based on the book of George Orwell. Ramya can talk about it a lot more articulately than I can, but it's been the review that Jacob and Ramya did of 1984 at AMI Audiobook Review is worth listening to because they did a phenomenal job in explaining what this unique product is, who's in it, et cetera, and then going through the themes and all the other aspects of that book that many of us read in high school way too many years ago.
Oh, good heavens, yes.
And it was great to revisit it. Ramya, what were some of your thoughts on what you experienced?
And mine is contrary to what most people experience, which is that they read the original version of 1984 by George Orwell, which I hadn't. So this experience was my first into 1984, and it was incredible. I mean, first of all, Audible original products are impeccable just because you're signing up for production value, right? But then there's so much more beyond that. So I will just say, check out the podcast episode. And we are going to be speaking with the writer of the show as well, Joel White. So we're looking forward to that conversation.
Yeah, we have a clip too, don't we? Let's just take a quick
listen, guys. From Audible.
This is Big Brother. Freedom is slavery.
Is it just me? Am I alone in possessing a memory?
I'm with you, Winston.
I am on your side.
Ignorance is strength.
The dog-haired girl. The way she looks at me.
I'm on to you, Winston Smith.
I am always here to protect you, to watch over you, and I am always watching.
Remember mandatory reading, Andy, that was in high school back in the day, 1949, George Orwell original at that. And what was the other one? Brave New World. But I like his other book. When you look at, Watership Down? That was the one I enjoyed. And I remember reading that darn thing in grade like two or three when the teacher read it to us. A little beyond our years, but really nice. And sounds like Rumi, you guys really did it spot on. Yep, congratulations.
Yep. Check it out. Check out the episode.
It's curious, Kelly, that we read these things, that and Lord of the Flies. Yep. Some pretty curious content to be feeding into the minds of 13-year-old kids. Mm-hmm. Eh? Like that was.
What was the one you were talking about earlier, Ramya, with Snowball? No, Snowball's from Watership Down with Animal Farm with Boxer
Animal
and all
Farm,
that.
That's right.
We did that one early, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
full circle with Orwell. Yep.
Full circle, yeah. Check out that particular podcast, and My Life in Books with Red Sail is another podcast. Mm-hmm. It's an audiobook related one. Now that's an author interview, and Red is a brilliant author himself, and an episode I'd like to spotlight is called After the Miracle by Max Wallace. It's the political crusades of Helen Keller. That it takes a different look at Helen Keller's life rather than just the so-called the miracle. It looks at Helen Keller's political work and passions and so on and so forth. So that's one I'd like to spotlight. Max Wallace, the After the Miracle, Political Crusades of Helen Keller.
Andy Frank, we've been spotlighting him here on Voices today. Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. We're, of course, over time. We'll do Voices once a month right here on Kelly and Ramya.
Stick around because we're wrapping up the show together after the break, but I want to tell you about the four most famous words when you're taking flight. Ha, you're not going to like them, though. We'll be right back. It's Kelly and Ramya. Welcome back. We're just wrapping up the show here. Only a couple of minutes left, so let's get to Now with Dave Brown. They have a show lined up for you at 9 a.m. Eastern time on AMI TV. Kels, what do they got planned?
Well, a lot going on tomorrow, as usual on their program. Earth Day is happening on April 22nd. Anne Camozzi reflects on the evolution of climate and policy changes through the decade. Will the Canadian disability benefit be reflected in the 2024 federal budget? Reporter Megan Gilmore will give us an overview about that. And the Saskatchewan Teachers Federation began work to rule as part of the ongoing job action as the part of the dispute with the province. Journalist John Loki, he'll give us that story on Now with Dave Brown tomorrow morning starting at 9 a.m. on AMI TV. Check it out. They're also available as well via podcast.
Now, I'm not going to be telling you what, because we've totally run out of time. I'm not going to be telling you anything more, just teasing that the next time I get a closing moment in, it's going to be out the four most divisive words that you'll hear or experience on a flight. And it gets pretty intense. I found this article from the Wall Street Journal, and I really had no idea how bad it can get on flights in this context of swapping seats. So that's what we'll get to next time. In the meantime, though, let's look ahead to tomorrow's show. If you come back at 2 p.m. Eastern time for the Wednesday edition of Kelly and Ramya, we're talking about the second taping of the All Access Comedy Special in Halifax in May. And AMI Communications Specialist Greg David is going to tell us the details as well as how you can get your free seats.
Okay, Norwegian startup Exitec is hoping to make outdoor adventuring more accessible, folks. We're going to be talking about an ATV designed for wheelchair users who can enjoy the gnarliest of outdoor environments.
Very cool. It's going to be a fun show. Join us back here at 2 p.m. Eastern time on AMI TV tomorrow.
Hi, it's Irene, the director of Kelly and Ramya. I want to talk about the passage of time. The older I get, the quicker the days go by. Doesn't really matter whether my days are jam-packed or if I'm just being a couch potato. Weeks fly by. I'm trying to get the world to slow down, and the answer for me is to be mindful and in the moment. This is not as easy as it seems. How many of us arrive at a destination as if on autopilot? You get there, but you're not exactly sure of all of the details. I find this particularly disconcerting. It means that I probably had monkey brain going on, and that means lots of chattering happening in my head. Everyone uses the phrase multitasking as if it is a skill to be praised and cherished. While I admit that there are times when being able to do several things at once, perhaps in a crisis, is a great skill to have, but perhaps in our day-to-day lives, we need to focus on one thing at a time and do it well and with mindfulness. Spring seems to me the perfect time to start this practice. I plan to notice all of the activity and new life going on around me. Buds sprouting up on the trees, the smell of new grass growing. Maybe in this way, I will learn to enjoy the journey instead of focusing on a destination or an endpoint/conclusion.
Hi, I'm Red Sale, inviting you to download the latest episode of My Life in Books, where internationally acclaimed authors discuss their lives, their work, and three books that have resonated with them. That's My Life in Books, available wherever you get your AMI podcasts.